The dangers of playing football.
The dangers of discontinuing statins.
Can an intramuscular injection help people with HIV stay on their meds?
And the outcomes in people that have had uncomplicated strokes.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on July 28th, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, you pointed out that this is the second week in a row we are discussing something from the Canadian Medical Association Journal. That's a look at outcomes relative to stroke and transient ischemic attacks, or TIAs. But you also wanted to shout out to Tom.
He is a partner of ours, been a longtime listener, and always gives us feedback about how we're doing on social media. So a shout out to you, Tom. Thank you.
Hey, Tom. Let us turn to the study then. This one was a little bit concerning for me, taking a look at, wow, if you've had a stroke or a TIA, what happens over the long haul?
One of the great virtues of this study is how it was done. And it's a longitudinal case control study that included all ambulatory or hospitalized patients with stroke or a TIA that were discharged from one of the regional centers in Ontario over a 10-year period. They looked at those that had an uncomplicated stroke. They matched those to other individuals during that same time period. And they looked at the outcome over the next 1, 3, and 5 years. How did the individuals with stroke or TIA do with respect to having death, a recurrent stroke, a heart attack, or admission to a long-term or continuing care facility? Over 26,000 individuals matched to about 260,000 controls. And here's what they found that was very disconcerting, is that most of us think that once you've had a stroke or TIA, in the first 90 days or perhaps the first year, your risk of having one of those things is high. And it is. It's about 2 to 3-fold higher, if you look at all outcomes, than the controls. However, that doesn't stop at 1 year. It continues to 3 years and even up to 5 years.
And here's what I'd like to find out. We know what the risk factors are for stroke, and we know what the risk factors are for recurrent stroke. So let's talk about that. How were these things managed in these folks who still continued to have this increased risk?
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't get that granular. What this should inform us is that many of our treatments are short-term. For example, rehabilitation. It goes on for several weeks or several months afterwards. What this tells me is that we got to be very aggressive about managing risk factors, cigarette smoking, diabetes, hypertension, proper medications for atrial fibrillation. And we can't do it for just 90 days or a year. We need to be on this for 3 years, even 5 years after the stroke.
I guess that's one take home that I would absolutely give to someone who's had either a TIA or a stroke. Hey, you need to pay attention to all these risk factors and hopefully manage them. What about comorbidities in these folks? Were they addressed?
Well, it's interesting you mention that because most of these individuals have one or more of those comorbidities you mentioned. About 3/4 of them have hypertension. A significant portion have diabetes. Many are cigarette smokers and many have atrial fibrillation. So these strokes and TIAs didn't occur in isolation. They occurred in the setting of these modifiable risk factors.
Okay. Since you've already mentioned then recidivism with regard to taking statins, let us then turn to Annals of Internal Medicine, taking a look at just how toxic that particular choice might be.
It's estimated that 25 to 50% of patients stop taking their statin within the first 6 months of when they're prescribed, and after 2 years, as many as 75% have stopped them. The major thing that people perceive they have is some sort of myalgia, that is muscle tenderness or musculoskeletal problems. Well, what this study did was it examined what the risk is in individuals for whom statins have been prescribed. It looked at all patients that had a presumed adverse reaction to a statin between 2000 and 2011 at two centers. What they discovered was that among 28,000 study patients, those that had reported an adverse effect, about 70% continued taking a statin. They lowered the dose or they just kind of made their way through it or they changed to a different statin, and 30% discontinued. And over the course of the next 4 years, those that continued the statin, about 12% of them had a stroke or heart attack or death. Those that discontinued, 14%. So there's an absolute difference of about 2%. What that means is if you stop a statin, about 1 in 60 of those patients will die prematurely.
And of course, we have noticed that widely reported side effects, muscle pains, and all that sort of thing are actually really very rare. So what are the things that are making people say, I don't want to be on a statin anymore?
Most of the time, if there are complaints, it's not really due to the statin at all. And sometimes we just put that idea in their head and people develop symptoms. That's called the nocebo effect. There's an interesting editorial that accompanied this. There's an internet-driven cult that really is dissuading people from using statins. What it pointed out was if you go on the internet and type in statin benefits, it'll pull up about 650,000 articles. If you pull up the same thing and call statin risk, there's about 3 million articles. And they oftentimes offer alternatives that have never been proven. So to a large extent, the internet helps drive that.
Sounds an awful lot like the vaccination issue, doesn't it? That is something that we should say, hey, be very careful. We've heard this caveat before about what information on the internet you trust, especially with regard to making healthcare choices.
And most studies show even those individuals that have had an adverse effect, 70 to 80% of them tolerate a statin perfectly fine.
On that note, let's turn from these things to an issue that's about to become a lot more apparent, I guess, to all of us who are front and center as football season is poised to begin. Let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association, a concerning study taking a look at postmortem examinations of brains of men who had played football and the evidence of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE.
This is the largest study of CTE that's been reported to date. And by nature, these are retrospective studies because the only way to diagnose chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, is to do it pathologically. And a number of relatives of individuals that have played football have donated their brains for study. This is a report of 202 football players. Their brains were examined looking for signs of CTE, and independently, the researchers interviewed relatives of individuals to ask them about whether they had any issues regarding cognition, dementia, or adverse behavior. And they looked at all football players. About 87% of them had evidence of CTE. For those that played professional football, it was 99%. Virtually all of them had evidence of CTE. Most of these individuals, 85 to 95%, had either trouble with cognition, early dementia, or behavioral problems as well. It suggests that professional football players have a very high incidence of CTE.
And of course, we know other information about that. For example, even with the structure of the helmets and attempts to reduce the amount of stress that occurs as the brain sloshes against the hard case of the skull, none of those really seem to be impacting on this.
It may be too early to tell. Caveats about this particular one. There's obviously some bias. People that are most likely to have their relatives' brains examined are those that are more likely to have CTE and more likely to have some sort of behavioral or cognitive dysfunction. So we have a lot more studies to do.
A lot more longitudinal study, but I would still suggest that right now we really need to think about ways to reduce that kind of injury in football.
And I'd say not only football, but also in a motor vehicle accident, because more people get concussions from that than any other activity. And then in our military servicemen and servicewomen as well. So you're right. We still have a lot of work to do.
Okay. Finally, then let's turn to The Lancet. I said, hey, would getting an intramuscular injection allow people who have HIV and are on medicine for that make their lives simpler?
For a number of years now, we've had very effective antiretroviral therapy. So the question is, once you get someone's viral load down, how effective are these injectable forms compared to the oral forms? In this particular study, individuals in whom they were able to get the viral load down, they put them on once a day oral medication, an injection once monthly, or an injection once every other month. And they followed them for up to 96 weeks. In those that received oral medication, viral suppression was maintained in 84%. Those with a one-monthly injection, 87%, and with the every other month injection, 94%. It's as effective, but I don't think we have enough data that suggests it's more effective. Now, you might say it's more effective if people aren't adhering to their oral medication, and that would obviously be the case.
Right, and so that's why I think this study is important. And I suggested to you before we started to record that while it's one thing domestically to ask people to take a once daily oral medication and have them comply with that, I think in the places where we really know HIV transmission is a huge burden, a lot of people's lives in those places are pretty chaotic. And so if they could get an injection once a month or once every 2 months and simplify that part of their lives, I think that would be a pretty attractive option.
Now, on the flip side, there are some people that just don't want injections. The second thing is, currently our health systems are not configured to be giving regular injections to a large number of people. So it would require us to develop different processes to make sure that's done appropriately.
We'll be watching. I especially think this could get even more attractive if it was once every 6 months or some other kind of a strategy where it got to be even less intervention needed.
Absolutely. And the other place where this may find value is in pre-exposure prophylaxis as well in individuals that don't have HIV, but partners may. A very preliminary study, very encouraging, and there'll be a lot more studies forthcoming.
Okay. I think this week on the blog, I'm going to talk about the statin use and especially the intervention with the internet and information gleaned there. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.